Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 43 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
I am Marco Mendoza. I'm a bass player. I like to call myself a musician. Don't ask me why, but for a lot of reasons. I'm a bass player. I've been doing this for, I like to keep it at 36, 37 years, only so I don't feel so ancient. It might be closer to 85.
Right. And dog years, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I've been around the industry for a while, and I've been one of those lucky guys that my journey has been, it's been toppled with a lot of highlights, you know, a lot of bands that I've been working with, including, just to name a few, and I hate to name drop, that's not me, but for the sake of this interview, Bill Ward was his first solo album that I got invited to participate in, collaborate with him, and we met in sobriety. So, it's funny enough, you meet the strangest people in AA meetings in the '80s, because that's when everything was falling apart for a lot of folks. So people were getting into sobriety, which is cool. I did too. I was one of those guys that, had a terrible time anyway. It was time for my sobriety to happen, and we met at an AA meeting, musicians meeting down in Newport Beach, California. And I knew who he was, of course, and then some of his band members from Black Sabbath were also trying to get sober, and they were around, and you could see that. So it was pretty cool. But at this particular meeting, we connected, and I think he knew who I was. I was a bass player, and we started talking, and he mentioned, you know, his project, his solo project that he was doing, and he said, "Marco, I would love to have you come down, you know, and check it out, and maybe play on a few tracks, would you?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely." So that was the beginning of my, what I like to call, my real career, because up to that point, it was pretty nebulous, I have to say. I can't think of a better word. I don't, a lot of stuff was going down in my career, my professional musician career. But there was a lot of partying going on, a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs, a lot of my life was just in shambles. It was just falling apart. So I got sober. And so the date that I like to call it the beginning of my career was September 20th, 1987. So that's when the real stuff started happening in my career. So my first gig, and I hadn't played, mind you, I hadn't played music in a year and a half or almost 2 years, because I lost it all interest in all that. Was my participation in that album with Bill.
Which was 1989 along the way.
Hey, thank you very much. I was trying to think of the date, but very good, 1989. Yeah. So it was shortly after when it was released. I think it was done a year before, but I was fresh out of sobriety. And it was amazing, man, for me to be in the company of so many heavy hitters. You know, Jack Bruce was on it, and Ozzy was on it, and Zakk Wylde, and I believe Tim Bogart as well, and just a lot of the who is who in the business were playing on that album. And so I felt really humbled, and I felt like this was a great opportunity. So Bill started talking to us right away about having a band and going out and touring behind this album. And of course I said yes. So and to this day I give him a lot of credit, because that's what sparked my career in sobriety and my real career in the music business, where I was showing up when I was supposed to show up.
what was going on before that? Because I mean, I was in that world as a music writer, and I remember your name being floated around.
Oh.
Was this like are you just because one is it's amazing to hear you talk so openly about your sobriety, which I think is an important thing, and people should do it more because more often than not
Yes.
people hide it.
Yeah.
But what was going on? Like, was it that you felt the career wasn't clicking? Was this just like a mess of childhood stuff? Like, where were you at that? Because you were in such an interesting place at the right time too back then.
Exactly. And well, to be honest, Mitch, I could say that I was your typical textbook alcoholic addict candidate. In that I came from, and I love my parents, and I've gone through the process of working the steps and all that, and I've done the healing and all that. Thank God, I got my spirit and my psychological and emotional situation pretty stable, and I managed to grow out of that. And I did the process of forgiving and forgiving myself and all that for all the damage I did out there. And I did a lot of damage. Two divorces, children, mental wards and suicide attempts and all that. And yes, I can talk about it, but we would need another 2 or 3 hours. That's another interview. Maybe we can do that because there's a lot of in-depth stuff that I and emotional and psychological, spiritual as well, that I like to touch on when I talk about sobriety. It's let's just say my life was a wreck. It was out of control. I was thrown into the business very young. The first tour that I did, I grew up in Mexico, by the way, in the little town south of the border, San Diego, which is where I'm at right now, Tijuana. And so I started your typical, musician that starts in garage bands. And then you start growing. For me, there was no doubt in my mind, in my heart, in everything, in every cell of my body that I was going to be doing music for a long time. Because I fell in love with it, the passion was there. It just took over. Music became my friend. It became everything to me. So I started spending a lot of time doing it, and as things would have it, I guess I started getting better and better and better at my craft, and not to get specific about a lot of things, but I started getting recruited by a lot of bands that were touring and recording bands, and so I ended up on this big tour to Mexico City with this band that already had some albums recorded, and some of the members came from different bands, and they were doing the majors, they were in a different level. So when I got recruited, I was 16 years old, and I got recruited because I sang, and I was a singer bass player, and that was the main thing. And so I went and ended up in Mexico City. I met my wife. I got married at 16. I had two children by the age of 18, and a career in the music business. And like I said, if we had more time, I could get more specific about what happened. But let's just say the machine and the monster of the music business just tore me up.
So let's get specific in one area, which is the bass. So when did the bass come to you? How were you introduced to the instrument? What did you think about it? How did you fall in love with it?
Oh, okay, that's a good one. I started playing guitar. Guitar was introduced to me. I was a middle child. And the guitar was bought. It was a gift to my brother, my older brother, who's 2 years older. Who, may he rest in peace. He passed away last year. But the guitar, him being the oldest brother, the oldest sibling, I'm your typical middle child. He would, and I don't mean that in a resentful way. It's just what it is. He would get everything. He's the boy. He's the man. The house. So he got a guitar. He wanted a guitar. He got an acoustic guitar that came from South Mexico. That nothing fantastic, but a very inexpensive, but a great guitar to play and learn. So that guitar, after a few months, he lost interest, like he did, and the guitar was laying around. And I started playing guitar. There was also the piano that my grandmother came when my parents had divorced. My grandmother came from Mexico City with a piano, and she was a piano teacher. So there was a piano and a guitar all of a sudden. The piano was very interesting to me, and I loved it. I was fascinated by it, but I couldn't get over the hump of getting on the piano and everybody in the house could hear me play and make mistakes and all that. So I was very introverted and very insecure. So therefore, the guitar, I could grab the guitar and go hide somewhere and learn at my own pace. So that's how I started learning the guitar. The chords and all that. I started learning songs and realized, wow, I can play hundreds of songs with three chords, you know? So that's what it was. And so later on, we put a band together thanks to my dad. My dad was really cool. He surrounded us with equipment and guitars and all that. And later on, I found out he was just doing that to keep us out of trouble. He said,
like, good enough reason as any, right?
Well, that's great, man. But he was also a musician. He was a clarinet player, Benny Goodman. So he was a music fan. There was big band music playing around all the time, you know. But so my brother was a drummer. He ended up with drums, got him a drum set. I was a guitar player. And then we found two other brothers that were two guitar players and singers. And so we started playing, you know, garage bands. And then I'll never forget my first gig that we did for one of my cousin's birthday. And I was so freaked out, man. I could never, the typical, you've heard stories of people doing this where they can't face the audience. And that was me. Was like, my dad had to come up on stage and we only knew like five songs or whatever. And so we repeated, but we played for about an hour maybe. But he used to come up on stage, just face that way. Just smile. But I'm making a lot of mistakes, Dad. That's okay. Just keep smiling and keep playing. Don't worry about the rest.
Keep moving.
Keep moving forward. And you know what? To this day, these voices are in my head. My dad saying, don't worry. Keep smiling. Everybody makes mistakes. You just remember where you're at. Don't lose your spot and keep playing the song, you know. So that's how it started.
But when did you fall in love with it? Because a lot of us start sort of that way. Brothers playing guitar. It's exactly my story. Middle child, same thing. Right. But at one point, you sort of like discovered Jaco like I did, and then off you go to the races. What was your moment?
For me, it was when I got recruited by this other band that was doing better gigs. They were doing the school bands now, and they were doing gigs, official gigs. They had a van they had a band and they had a name for the band, but my brother got recruited and we renamed the band Peace Association. And so now all of a sudden we're working on the weekends. Everybody's going to school, but now we're doing gigs and a little more organized. And we had our own PA and we had a band and everybody were playing. I remember we were playing a lot of Grand Funk Railroad and Creedence Clearwater Revival. And for Mexican standards, we were way ahead of ourselves. So we started getting popular. And that was, I'm trying to remember that the one gig that we did that was called, the students took over the golf course there in Tijuana because they wanted to build, I'm trying to remember all the details, but we got invited to this festival. And I think there was 5,000 or 6,000 kids. And that's when I realized this is amazing. This is, I think I'm going to be doing this for a while. And that was the eureka moment when I went, this is great. I love this. And the band sounded great. We sounded great. And we got off the stage and then people wanted our autograph and take pictures. And it was like, wow, this is very cool, man. People wanted to document the moment, you know. But
what's interesting with you, Marco, is I was wondering before we started this conversation, because I've been following your career from back in the Bill Ward days and a big fan of the genre, was in the industry for a while as well.
I'm flattered, man.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm always interested if, you know, a guy like you, you're hanging out at a barbecue with some friends and someone is there and they go, who have you played with? And I could rattle off it for you. Ted Nugent, Whitesnake, Thin Lizzy, Black Star Riders, Alias, Blue Murder, Lynchville. I could go on.
Yes.
Is it like Nuge and Whitesnake that always sort of floats to the top just so that you can anchor for someone the type of musician you are? Or do you shy away from the fact that you were in such big bands?
I'll tell you honestly, and I'm here on vacation with my family. We're in a beautiful place here called Paradise Point in Mission Bay, San Diego. And we come here whenever we can. It's like a staycation because we can drive down from my home. And we go, you know, we'll be water skiing and jet skiing and doing beach and all that. And people, I look different. Let me just say that. I know I look different. I'm all tatted up. I have that burnt out fried look from years and
from the road and too many time zone shifts.
Yeah. And so I can't get rid of that. And so people start looking at me and I don't fit the profile, you know. The families here are, you know, families that work, you know, and they come out every summer or whatever. And they come out from the Midwest, you know. I was talking to – we were in the jacuzzi yesterday. I was talking to this cat, and I was there with his kids, and he was checking me out. You know, he's from Wisconsin. Excuse me. And, you know, I hear Wisconsin, I immediately want to start talking Nugent, you know. Right. And hunting and all that. But he started on the conversation and on his own. And he finally, after, I don't know, about half an hour, 40 minutes of talking, and he finally said, "So what's your name?" I said, "Marco." And then he started checking me out. And I said, "You're a musician, right?" I said, "Yeah, yeah. You know, I've been doing this for a while and it's been great. So what genre, what kind of music, what instrument do you play?" And he started getting into it a little bit. And I finally told him I'm a bass player and I've been doing this, and so in his mind, I'm like, "So how many gigs a weekend do you play? You play on the weekends, right?" I said, "No, man, this is, I've been doing this full time. I've been one of those guys that's been really blessed and very lucky and whatever you want to call it. My journey has been amazing. A lot of highlights. I started getting into it because once you get into the conversation, it's hard for me to shy away from it. If the door opens up, then we, you know." And he seemed very cool. He seemed like he wasn't going to get whatever excited or influenced in any way. So we could just have a conversation, dad to dad. And he was telling me how he's a grandfather. He had his grandkids around. I said, "Yeah, I'm a grandpa too." And it was cool. And then as soon as I mentioned, he insisted, to be honest, I was trying to shy away because when I come out with my family, I just want to be a dad. I want to be a husband. It really keeps me grounded. And so he finally got it out of me. I said, "Yeah, I've been playing with a few bands." Nugent, and his eyes just boom, you know. I don't know a lot of people that aren't fans of Ted Nugent in the U.S., especially in the Midwest, East Coast, you know. So his eyes got 10 times the size and he was, "Oh wow, man." And we started talking and then the other stuff comes out. I gave him my website and you know, MarcoMendoza.com and then the DeadDaisies.com. And he split for about an hour with the skits. And then I see him again and he's like, "Oh man, let's take a picture. Let's do this. Let's do that." And it's like, and I'm very grateful. Trust me. I realize that we need fans. And I realize that, you know, I'm blessed and I am so privileged to have the life that I have because of the fans. But it's a trip. To answer your question, it's, if I can, I'll go around it so as not to get overly whatever, because what's happened in the past, and not to sound pretentious in any way, is because that was one person, but then he goes and talks to another person, and then all of a sudden you start getting the looks, and yeah, you're having dinner with the family, and then boom, people come over, "Hey, la la la, let's take a picture. Can you sign this? Can you do that?" And I always do it. I mean, I'm always going to be grateful, but it's nice to unplug. That's my point. Yeah. It's nice for me. What keeps me grounded, Mitch, is the fact that I get off the tour. I came home from New York and I get up in the mornings and hang out with my kids, do breakfast, jump in the pool, go to the beach, do some bike riding, throw the ball, around, hang out with my daughter, her friends and all that. Just become a dad, but become a regular cat, which I am. And we all are. But when we get on tour, there's a persona that you're trying to live up to. You know, there's a profile that you're trying to live up to. And I understand the dynamics, and I appreciate it, and I try to show I'm grateful for my career.
I want to talk a bit about Whitesnake, because I remember seeing you live with them many times, and that's a band that I've loved and followed from basically day one. And you know, Rudy Sarzo, awesome. Yes. He's been on the show, great player, also quite the resume, like you, incredible. But I remember really watching you a lot during those shows and thinking, wow, this guy really is such a great fit for this band. And then you weren't in it. And I didn't have closure, so I need closure. What happened?
Oh, okay. What happened is, like it happens in the industry, if you're not part of, how do I put this delicately? I don't want to step on any toes, because sure. that Whitesnake was definitely a highlight from my career. The things that I learned and how David Coverdale impressed me in such a good way, and how he inspired me to become a better artist and a musician. Be, you know, everybody I played with, including, you know, Ted Nugent and Thin Lizzy. I mean, there's so many cats. I learned so much, but David, for some reason, he's very, very focused, extremely focused. And when I left that band, that's what I took away with me, you know. But what happened with him was that we were all into building a new band that would be, you know, the band that would be touring for a while, that we would be recording a new album so that everybody could be involved in the writing and the publishing, and create a little more of a work situation on the business side, a little more of a financial, you know,
taste.
More
involved. Yeah.
A little taste. And it started not happening. So we found ourselves touring and touring and touring. And to me, in my opinion, that lineup was just so amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, we felt it on stage. We knew we had something very, very special. I'm getting chills right now.
That's crazy.
Because we used to have this conversation, all of us looking at each other going, what the hey, man, this, does David know what's going on? I mean, there's everywhere you look, there's, you know, you got a lot of power and a lot of talent, and even the look, everybody looked really cool, and we got along extremely, extremely well. We were all brothers. We were a band that would have dinners together and hang out on our days off. I mean, it was like we do things together, and it was like a brotherhood, and we were all hoping that it would last. And then some offers started coming in, and David wasn't ready for him, and he's entitled to make decisions on the business side and all that. But for me personally, I started losing interest when I realized that we were only going to be touring. We were a touring band. We were going to be sidemen forever, for a while. And so I got married again. I have to throw that into the mix. Something happens. I don't know if you're married, Mitch, but something happens when you get married and you start having children. Your life changes.
A little, yeah, like a ton. And look, even having my friends from back in the 80s and 90s from the music industry, and I look at my life now and their life, and they, even when they're doing fly-ins, I'm like, it's really complex when you're married and have kids and you get older. It's just not the same gig.
Yeah, exactly. And so for me, I'll mention it anyway because it's true. I was having a great run with real estate investments here in Southern California. And so I was investing, and I was up to my ears in debt because I was single. And then I get married, and then things change. We start having kids right away. And it became important for me to be home with my children. And I started looking at what, in the long run, in the bigger picture, what are we doing here? Are we just working? Are we planting seeds for the future? Are we, what's going on? So you kind of take inventory. You know what I'm saying? That's one thing that I am glad about in sobriety. I've become a little more real. I'm a realist, you know, getting the ego aside and all that. When I started looking at the situation, I went, yeah, this is a great band, amazing band. Where are we going with this? And so that started happening. I started looking at the situation. And mind you, again, without sounding pretentious, I was getting tons of offers. I mean, I could drop some names forever. To go here, to do this, to go audition here. They wanted me to record there. And I was letting go of a lot of work that was for me, as you know, my individual, my solo career. My career, my personal career started taking a second and third seat. And so I started weighing things out and realized that it was like when David decided to take a year off and we weren't getting any answers about what the next move was going to be, what we're doing, are we recording. I know that we shot a video that to this day, it's a great video. I haven't seen the whole thing top to bottom, but bits and pieces that I have, it looks great, it sounds great, and it got so, it was like a bestseller and in a long time, in the still of the night. And so that was in place, and I'm like, you know, I'm just, I can't stay still, man. Neil Sean called me. Out of all the calls that I got, Neil Sean was one of them. And I admire Neil from, and I have for the longest time as a musician, as a player, and he was the coolest cat. So I got this thing to do Soul Circus. And he came to me, he saw me play at NAMM show and says, Marco, you're my guy. You have to do this. Come on. And so it was Dean Casanova, Jeff Scott Soto, Neil Sean, and myself. How can you pass on that, right? So I got to the place where I decided I'm not going to pass on anything anymore. Shortly after, Ted Nugent called again, and I came back and worked with him for a little bit. Thin Lizzy was calling. I'm going to drop names now. Dolores O'Riordan, my little sister, man, may she rest in peace.
Yeah, I actually want to talk. So let's hold right there. The other side of you that again, like there's sort of so many dimensions to your music, and I know you even consider yourself a chameleon, and I think it's amazing because here we sit at, you know, 25 plus minutes into the conversation, we're still in the intense world of hard rock, but yeah. Again, like, you did work with Right Said Fred. You did work with a guy I've known for a while, Rock Voisin, up here in Quebec. And then for sure, Dolores was somebody I definitely wanted to ask you about because yeah. It's also been, you know, knowing about your sobriety, knowing the things you had been through and knowing how candid you are, you know, whether it's Dolores, Chris Cornell, Chester. I mean, it's been a bit much for fans of music with what's happening in this. I'm not saying it's all alcohol or drug related. There's depression, there's psychological issues, there's other problems there, but tell me a bit about what your relationship was like with Dolores. I know that was like 2009-ish for No Baggage. How did you meet her? And just your feelings. I mean, it's a bit crazy what's going on lately, I find.
Yeah. Well, being a, you know, to address the drug infested society that we live in now, it really bugs me, man. And again, we need 2 or 3 hours on that topic because I am your textbook sober guy. I'm getting chills again, man, because I came from suicide attempts and mental wards and depression and wanting to end my life many, many times. And I was the heroin addict, and I was the alcoholic and the pill, anything I could put in me to get me away from who I was in my life, I would do it. Psychologically, spiritually bankrupt, emotionally bankrupt, totally gone. A human being, if you could call me that, that's just barely existing. And just barely existing to medicate myself and see what the next day brought. That was my existence then. And so I know what goes on with opiates being available now and people prescribing the docs, you know, the medical business that it is, because that's what it is, the bottom line. It's total business, you know. The doctors get incentives from the pharmas to sell this stuff. And I'm a proponent, and because of my own experience, not to medicate. And I know there's exceptions to the rule. Yeah, I'm not a doctor, but if I came out of all that hell where I'm at today, I'm not perfect, not by a long shot, and I have a lot of things to work on. But the difference is, Mitch, is that I'm sober. I deal with life on life's terms, head on, with my eyes wide open. I go through all of it, the roller coaster, and that's what makes it beautiful. These are the things that I try to talk to the people that are around me when I see people drinking or socially drinking, whatever, and then I see the patterns and the flags. I've been around the sobriety long enough to know the difference. Well, Dolores, I met Dolores, to come back to her. I'm trying to remember the year, but I met her through her husband, Don Burton, who is now her ex-husband, and they have three kids.
Because that was the no baggage stuff for 2009, I think.
Exactly. Don was a tour manager for Duran Duran. I met him going back to Canada, which you haven't mentioned, and I was surprised. You remember Sheriff?
Of course. Okay. So yeah, the Lanny and Freddie Kirchy. And Alias, for sure. And again, guys that I was really connected to back then.
Yeah, so Alias, I got recruited in L.A. when I started my career again. I was that sober guy, and I had the label of being a bit of a session guy, which was great at the moment because I could read a little bit of music. I could play different styles. I had the look. People were considering me. I mean, I did a bunch of... I auditioned for Cher. I auditioned for Lionel Richie, la la la, to drop a few names that were massive. But so I get the call from Left Bank Management, which is the Kovac brothers, big management company who were managing everybody, and they still manage Motley Crue, Nicki and all that. So I get a call, Alias. Well, the band Sheriff is a new band now. It's Fred Kirchy and Steve DeMarkey.
Exactly.
They're looking for a bass player to do their new album and la la. And so I came in and played with them. And they were looking at Ricky Phillips as well. I remember saying hello to Ricky as he was leaving. And I walk in and go, I really don't dig auditioning, but let's do it. And what I brought, this is another thing that we've kind of not touched on, but I brought a fretless bass with, which is my passion. And to this day is my, when I'm given a choice, I will go there. My fretless bass tone for me is the ultimate. You can be very expressive. Anyway, I brought the fretless. I played 2-3 songs with them with a fretted. And then they said, what do you want to do? I said, well, let me plug in my fretless. And I got a lot of attention from them. Fred and Steve were big fans of fretless tone. And then they found out that I was working with Blue Murder, that I did this, and I la la la. And it was like, well, let's do the album. You're in. So they flew me out to Jersey, West Orange, and I'm trying to remember the name of the studio. Famous, world famous studio. Legendary. But anyway, not there anymore. Anyway, anybody and everybody recorded there. So all of a sudden I'm there, and we found that we dug each other so well. We had such a blast, and we were working so well, and we did a great album to this day. I'm trying to remember the title of it. But in those days, I was flying all over the place recording with everybody. So my connection was to Dolores, to come back. Don was the tour manager for that band. So Don Burton, later on, I ended up leaving on the road with some other project or whatever. We lost touch, but we stayed in touch because we all dug each other so well. But in particular, Steve DeMarkey, Don, and me were like, we just hit it off like brothers.
And Steve also worked with Dolores.
Yes, right. Exactly. So he ended up working with the Cranberries and right. Dolores,
exactly.
With the Cranberries and the solo project. So Steve and I would stay in touch, and he would come to my shows, when I was around with the big shows. And we stayed in touch. We'd come up to Canada a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
And then Don would come around and stay in touch. So the connection was this. Don went out tour managing for Left Bank for Duran Duran. And there was this little band that was coming out of Ireland that was called the Cranberries, that were pretty, you know, they had a little bit of a name in the UK, but not really crossed over to the US. So they're touring, and the story is that they were on tour for a month or two, opening up for Duran Duran, support slot, and then all of a sudden Linger blows up the video and the song, and there you go. So Don and Dolores became buddies on the road, like you do on tour. You know, you're a big family touring. And they fell in love, they got married, and all of a sudden Don became Dolores' manager. This, as soon as Don had a chance, I remember him calling me, "Marco, man, you got to meet my wife. She will love you. She will love you. You guys are the same person, la, la, la." He knew a little bit of my history. And so something happened. They were at the record plant doing a project with Mick Fleetwood. Here I am dropping names. I hate to do this, but...
It's your story, man. We want your story, so it's good. Go.
I know, but I'm not a big fan of that. But and I'll tell you why later. But anyway, so I get the call. So Marco, the bass player didn't show up for the Cranberries. We've been having some issues. Something's going on. I don't know what, but can you be here as soon as possible? And this is one of the benefits of living in L.A., Mitch. And I would get a lot of calls like this. I said, yeah, the record plant is, you know, West Hollywood. I'm in Studio City. I said, when do you need me? Well, when can you be here? As soon as possible. You know, the band's ready to roll and we're not recording because, yeah. And then he told me what it was. And Dolores, I said, I want you to meet Dolores. This would be great. I said, yeah, I can be there in an hour. Great. So I got up, grabbed my basses too, always brought my fretless, and got up there to the record plant. And Mick Fleetwood was there. Recording and a few other names, and Dolores is in the, you know, in the vocal booth and killing it. And I walk in, I'm like, okay, let's do this. I plugged in. They gave me the material. As they're doing that, I'm writing some charts, and I got in there, and boom, we recorded. And Dolores was just, she was just head over heels. She was just like loving and amazed. And how can you do this? Well, this is what we do, you know, we play everything. So we hit it off. And right there on the spot, I remember, and I know she's hearing, she's up somewhere listening to this. She's, Marco, you're going to be my bass player. I want to do a solo thing, because they were having some issues in the Cranberries. There was some stuff going on, like usual. And so I want to do a solo album in it. And so, would you be interested? I said, absolutely. So long story short, a time goes by. I don't know how long that was, but I get the call, and we're recording. We're recording all over the place. We're in England. We're in Toronto, because they have a place outside of Toronto. We're in London at a studio in London. And it was a great project, man. They were always, you know, Don and Dolores were always amazing with me. They treated me like part of the family. I was their brother. On the business side, they were very generous. They just took care of me, and I felt really appreciated. And Dolores would always look for me to kind of bring my two cents creatively and musically. You know,
are you able, because of what you've been through, though, to see people like that and see that there may be some pain, some issue, or are you just as shocked as the people? Like, I mean, look, I don't know her. I just know the music and love the music. So you see it and it's like a gut punch. Is it a gut punch to you, or do you see things always because you've been through so much where you're like, you know, ugh.
It really hurt me. And to this day, my wife is saying months later, are you okay? Because Dolores and I, and Don, but Dolores and I got really extremely close. She's like, you know, when you come across somebody that's you, it's your mirror. It's in every way, because without getting into her personal life, but a lot of the same issues that I had experienced years ago before I got sober, she was going through.
Right.
And so that was my thing, and that was my concern. And I loved her to death. There was nothing I wouldn't do for her. She would call me, want to talk, and most of the time it was about, I'm not feeling well. I want to drink. I want to take some pills, and and I'm going to get emotional now. She did call me one time. She says, Marco, I just need you close to me, because you represent everything I want to be. and it was heartbreaking. And I couldn't be there, you know. But she really respected me as a human being. Aside from the music, I'm getting emotional here, but it's amazing, man, when you see somebody with so much talent and her heart, her spirit, who she was as a person, a human being that, you know, very rare that they're around, especially celebrities like that are real, you know.
Super talent. I want to jump forward to sort of where we are now here in 2018, because, yeah, again, you know, you're a guy who just doesn't let go. You keep going. And one of the things I really appreciated about you a lot more as a musician is I sort of knew you as the rock guy, the Ted Nugent, the White Snake, the Black Star Riders, Bloom. And then as I was digging into more of the bass player side, this sort of solo life that you have of jazz and fusion and it's Latin influence and there's trios and I see you picking up a six string and a fretless and I'm just, and you're singing as you're playing. I was like, what? It's like schizophrenic for me. I'm like, who's this guy compared to the guy that I saw on stage not that long ago with White Snake or Ted Nugent?
Well, and nailed schizophrenia.
Yeah, it's like you call it a chameleon. I'm like, it's great. And here we are now, and you've got your solo album. You do another solo album that just comes out that's really cool and very different. But at the same time, on the rock side, I think a lot of your priority is with this band, the Dead Daisies, and they have your new album out called Burn It Down. And so what? Yeah. Talk a little bit about where we are right now, because it feels like you're busier than ever. You've got these two things going on. How did they come together so closely together? Talk a bit about where we're at.
It's like every time I wake up in the morning, like for example, today to put this thing together with you. And again, I apologize.
We had a lot of texts, you and me, Marco. We're friends now.
but I really mean it, man, because it's a whirlwind. There's so much going on because of where my career is at right now. I'm flattered. I'm always going to be flattered that anybody wants to talk to me. I find it, humbling, and I mean that from the bottom of my gut, you know, my heart, man. And so I am a people pleaser, and it's worked for me to my advantage in the business. So I try to do it all. I'm at today as I finally got a manager, bitch.
Not your wife.
Not my wife. We tried it and that didn't work because we have children, and that's another book, another interview. But I finally, because of what's going on, and there's so much going on, you're right, I'm a little schizophrenic, and I use that to my advantage as far as music is playing concerned, music playing is concerned. But for all those years that I've been planting seeds and doing this and doing that, it's coming to fruition right now. I see it. I'm getting chills again because I see it, I feel it, and I'm really grateful. And I can get emotional about it because it's been a long journey, bro. And I'm not a young man, but I'm so grateful. I can't tell you, man. I tried to live in the attitude of gratitude, you know. Because when I do that, when I live there, everything is fine. But as far as where I'm at,
just
today,
dig into the solo album and the fact that like it's like you've got solo and Dead Daisies, and they're like we're right here now.
We're right here now. well, my involvement with the Daisies started in 2013. I don't know if you know the story, but I will get into it a little bit. I was touring. I was out with Thin Lizzy on the Motley Crue Kiss package in Australia, and one of the bands I was supporting was David Lowie and his band. Amazing band. The girls, he had a couple of girls that a guitar player and a bass player, a singer, and they had some great songs. They were like, wow, this is cool. So I'd go out because we're in the back of the arena backstage, and I'd go out and listen. I'm always listening and checking it out, and I'm going, wow, that's some cool. So we started saying hello and said hello. And then all of a sudden, before the tour ended, his manager, David Edwards, who is now the manager for the Dead Daisies, came over and said, Marco, we dig what you're doing. We have this album. We've recorded some songs. I don't know that it was an album yet. It might have been, but we recorded some songs and in the studio, and We want you to hear it, and we're thinking about in the future, maybe going out and playing behind the album or the songs. I said, would you be interested? Said, yeah. And then they mentioned the fact that Richard Fortus, who had been part of Thin Lizzy alumni, was part of it, and Dizzy Reed and this and that. And I'm like, oh, cool. So I got home, and they send the music, and right away, I got to say, you know, when you hear something that just sparks you right off the bat, the first four bars, boom. And so that was it. And I heard this voice and I heard these songs. I'm going, this is very cool. I emailed back and sent me a few more. They sent me a few. And then I went on YouTube and I saw John Stevens sing and David and the cats playing. And I did a little bit of homework and I called back and I said, yeah, let me juggle some of my scheduling, because I was recording with Dolores and Neil Sean right now at that time. You know, they needed me for, was it 4 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. And so I was able to move my, reschedule everything, recording stuff. And I went down there. And from the moment, the first day of rehearsal, it was such a blast. The music was happening. Everybody was playing great.
A crazy band. You got John Corabi, formerly of the Scream, and he was the guy who inevitably replaced Vince Neil Motley Crue, Doug Ulrich, Dio, Whitesnake, on and on. Doug's a great guy. Dean Castronova, Journey, etc. And David, who I think to a lot of people in North America was more of an unknown next to those guys, but still the sort of player and a very interesting business guy. And it's an amazing group of very different players. And again, when I saw the band, it reminded me a little bit of seeing, again, you in that Whitesnake lineup of all these sort of stellar players. And just, it sounds so intense.
Thank you, man. Yeah. We, you know, the Dead Daisies is a hardworking band in every sense of the word. I mean, we are constantly chopping away, listening to ourselves, trying to figure out how we can sound better, how we can look better. It's a growing thing.
And so, but at the same time, you've got the solo album out, and it is, it's very different music, and so is there balance for you, or is it very clear sort of 1 week you're doing this or 1 month? How do you divide your time up?
To me, it's all music, Mitch, honestly. It's all music and it's all stuff that I want to do. Obviously, my solo thing is a great opportunity. So the Dead Daisies came up. We went do 2-3 albums. Because of the Dead Daisies, I believe labels were out there looking, the indies were looking at artists that were touring and doing that. And I started getting a bunch of calls because I hadn't done anything in 6 or 7 years. I started getting some offers. We love what you do as your solo artist. Can you consider this? Can you consider that? And I'm like, let's just say that nothing rang my bell. Nothing was like, I couldn't justify putting time aside to do it. And it was cool. It's mostly business, unfortunately, you know, but you learn how to make right decisions as you go along. You learn how to read things and do things that are going to benefit you in the long run. You learn that. At least I can say I've learned a little bit. So because of the Dead Daisies, the schedule of the Dead Daisies, it's a working machine, hard working machine in every sense, man. We've done, what, 4 albums in 3 years, 3.5 years, something like that. I think I'm told that next year we're going to lay back for a little bit. But this year it's just full. The schedule is going on strong. So when the label approached me to do my solo thing, I had to really take a look at and say, is this doable? And if we have some time available, I'm that guy. I'm going to make it happen. And so I had a few months where I was doing some dates in Europe already booked. And there was a window of 2 weeks before the date started. We finished September 3rd with the Dead Daisies in the U.S. By September 6th, I was in Copenhagen recording. we were done on the 19th. So that's what. You know, 12 days. Yeah. But we went in there, and I got to give a lot of credit to my brother, Soren Anderson, because he was very instrumental in, you know, he was producing, he was co-writing with me. He reads me so well, and he supports my vision where I want to go, the direction and all that. And so we got Viva La Rock, man. And it's getting a lot of attention now. It's getting, a lot of love. And so when that happens, you put something out there that kind of clicks with people, then you're going to start getting calls, you know, for work, a lot of work and opportunity. So yeah, it is a juggle, but I love what I do, Mitch. It's like, how can you get in when you love something? Can you get enough of it?
No, listen, Marco, it's an amazing story. And when I look back and think about those early days of hard rock and heavy metal and watching you transform and still be there and then do your solo stuff, it's an amazing story. And that's why I was so excited to have this conversation with you and have you share a little bit about all these corners that you've been in and continue to play in. I want to thank you for your time. Let people know where they can connect to your stuff.
Well, you can go to MarcoMendoza.com and TheDeadDaisies.com, obviously. The album for The Dead Daisies, amazing album. It's getting all kinds of accolades and attention. It's going to do something very cool. TheDeadDaisies.com, the album's called Burn It Down. And then Marco Mendoza, Viva La Rock is the album. And there's some other things cooking that we didn't have a chance to talk about. But let's just say, I'm just going to drop a few names for next year. Neil Sean, Greg Raleigh, Dean Casanova. La la la.
Oh boy. That's awesome, man. Marco, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, man. Let's do it again soon. Let's catch up. I really appreciate your efforts here and your attention.